This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, December the 11th, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, Mali enters another political crisis as troops arrest the Prime Minister. Human rights groups call on senators to release a 6,000-page report on CIA torture. And residents of the Pacific Northwest fight a proposal to build the country's largest coal export terminal. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. At least 10,000 protesters rallied outside the Michigan State Capitol today, and thousands more filled the halls. While inside the chamber, lawmakers passed contentious anti-union legislation 58-51. House members opposing the law immediately responded. Floor debate was rancorous, and after the vote, opponents introduced a number of amendments, all of which failed. State Representative Vicki Barnett proposed one of them that would have sent the measure to voters before becoming law.
The point of public hearing is to have these conversations in committee, where the people who are standing outside this building can come in and come to committee and voice their concerns with the bills. They have been shut out completely.
The so-called right-to-work law dramatically undercuts the power of organized labor in a state with a long union history. Governor Rick Snyder is expected to sign the law that would ban a requirement that non-union workers pay union dues in both public and private sectors. In Cairo today, both supporters and opponents of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi held dueling rallies. The country's judges reversed course again, announcing what they call a final decision not to oversee next Saturday's vote. And the IMF delayed a major loan to Egypt following the cancellation of tax hikes. Noel King has more.
Morsi's opposition, a loose coalition of liberals, secularists, Christians, and moderate Muslims who have united under an umbrella group called the National Salvation Front, massed outside of his presidential palace. Meanwhile, the president's supporters, many hailing from his Muslim Brotherhood, gathered in another Cairo neighborhood to declare their support for Morsi and for a referendum on the new Egyptian constitution, which is slated for Saturday. Egyptians who oppose Morsi are divided on whether to vote no to the constitution or boycott the referendum altogether. Egypt has been locked in a political standoff, which has at times turned violent since Morsi issued a decree on Thanksgiving night, granting himself sweeping new powers. Over the weekend, the president rescinded that decree, but he has refused to change the date of the constitutional referendum. Morsi and his supporters say he simply wants to usher the country more quickly through the transition to democracy. Opponents say his recent decrees render him little more than a dictator. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
A week after Typhoon Bopha hit the Philippines, more than 700 people are now confirmed dead. Nearly 900 more are still missing, and residents of hard-to-reach inland villages are running out of food and emergency supplies. And more than 5 weeks after Superstorm Sandy hit the U.S. East Coast, anger is rising in the hardest-hit communities. Peter Rue reports.
In far Rockaway, Queens, 10,000 residents are still without heat or electricity. Most lack insurance and are waiting for the city's rapid repair program to come to their aid. Many say Tishman Construction, the city's sole contractor, has been slow to respond. Meanwhile, mold threatens to spark a public health crisis. Faith leaders hosted a community forum Monday evening, calling on elected officials to do more. State Representative Joe Adabo told a packed gymnasium he would do everything in his power to steer resources where they are needed. Veterans of Occupy Wall Street have turned the skills they honed at last year's encampment outward. Together with community partners, they've been delivering basic necessities to many who say they've been neglected by the state. Citywide demonstrations demanding a people's recovery are planned for Saturday. Peter Rue, FSRN, Far Rockaway, New York.
The U.S. Department of Justice announced an agreement on oversight of the Orleans Parish Prison today, where they say a 2009 investigation found conditions that were unconstitutional. Zoe Sullivan reports.
Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Roy Austin, outlined the problems the Department of Justice identified in New Orleans jail.
Within the prison, we found a pattern or practice of unconstitutional and unlawful conditions, including physical and sexual assaults, excessive use of force, inadequate medical and mental health care, failures to protect against suicides, deficient sanitation and fire safety, and lack of translation services for Spanish-speaking, limited English proficient individuals.
The Southern Poverty Law Center sued the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office over these inhumane conditions and is a party to the agreement announced today. The agreement calls for updated policies regarding the use of force, adequate staffing and pay, adequate medical and mental health care, and a ban on housing teenagers with adults. Pending judicial approval, the courts will oversee the sheriff's compliance. A court date has been set for April 4th to address the issue of funding the stipulations of the agreement. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
The military hearing on Private First Class Bradley Manning's confinement is winding up at Fort Meade. The court heard closing arguments today on the defense claim that the conditions of Manning's pretrial detention were unlawful. The government argued they used an overabundance of caution to protect Manning. Manning is asking for all charges to be dismissed. The government is negotiating possible sentencing credits. There's no word when a decision is expected. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. The Senate Intelligence Committee convened today to discuss a more than 6,000-page report on torture committed by the CIA during the George W. Bush administration. But the report's findings may not be released to the U.S. public for a long time to come. Human rights groups want access to the report to bolster their efforts to hold the U.S. government accountable, including for the detention and torture of U.S. citizen Jose Padilla. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
For more than 3 years, the Senate Intelligence Committee has been researching whether the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation yielded any useful information. Arizona Republican John McCain, a longtime critic of torture who participated in the investigation, said the report's findings will be definitive.
I have said they did not get any meaningful information by torturing people. That's based on all of the information that I have and the debriefings and the intel over the years. I've said it for years.
The committee will vote later this week on whether to approve the report, but that doesn't mean it will be publicly released. If the report is approved, senators, White House, and intelligence agencies would begin a review process that could span years and would decide what information can be safely revealed.
The only reason that really would remain for keeping much of this classified is to prevent the American public from knowing what was done in their name, and we think that's inappropriate.
That's retired Brigadier General David Irvine, one of the many veteran officers calling on the committee to make as much of the report public as possible. He said there's no excuse for secrecy on this issue because many of the actions in question happened a decade ago, and some of the information is already declassified. He recently delivered his group's message to California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, the chair of the committee considering the report.
We have condemned what are euphemistically called enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, stress positions, forced nudity, sexual humiliation, beatings, drenching with cold water in cold temperatures, sleep deprivation for days at a time, sensory deprivation, singly and in combination as torture.
One person who was subjected to several of these techniques is U.S. citizen Jose Padilla, who was detained without trial and tortured for several years before being convicted of supporting terrorism. He tried to sue the Bush administration for violating his rights, but the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the petition multiple times over the past few years. On Tuesday, the American Civil Liberties Union and Yale Human Rights Clinic petitioned the Inter-American Court at the Organization of American States to review his case. Attorney Stephen Watt with the ACLU is representing Padilla.
What he's seeking in this proceeding is redress for his injury in the form of an explanation of why he was subjected to the mistreatment that he was, and an apology from the United States. This isn't about monetary compensation. It's about acknowledgement of the truth of what happened to him, which is something that U.S. courts have not afforded him.
The Senate report could reveal information that bolsters Padilla's case, including evidence that the U.S. violated international law by labeling Padilla and many others enemy combatants and using tactics banned by the U.N. Convention Against Torture. But Watt says the Senate's release of information must be followed by bringing those responsible to justice.
if you don't have accountability for past actions, there's a possibility that some ways down the line that this can all happen again. I mean, history shows that that's the case.
President Obama banned so-called enhanced interrogation when he came into office, but his administration has not prosecuted any of the officials responsible. The Intelligence Committee is expected to approve their report on the CIA's past use of torture this Thursday. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Mali earlier today, the Prime Minister, Sheikh Modibo Diarra, made this announcement on state television.
At this time of crisis, men and women concerned about the future of our nation want a calmed situation. It is why I, Sheikh Modibo Diarra, resign with all my government today, Tuesday, 2012.
On Monday, Diarra was arrested by soldiers at his home, and analysts say this statement was likely made under duress. Diarra was installed as Prime Minister following a military coup in March. Unrest in the country is growing as rebels and Islamic extremists in the north continue to make gains. For more, we're joined by Dr. Robin Edward Poulton, Mali expert at Virginia Commonwealth University's School of World Studies. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
Before Prime Minister Diarra resigned, soldiers arrested him Monday night at his home. Would you characterize this as another coup? And what were the grounds for his arrest?
The grounds for his arrest appear to be frustration, really. Sheikh Modibo Diarra is a famous NASA scientist. He ran one of the Apollo missions. He was a Microsoft figurehead, let's say, in Africa after he retired from NASA. And he was also the son-in-law of a former military president, Moussa Traoré. So he is not an unknown quality. He's a sort of national hero who's never done anything. And when he was appointed, it was with that sort of hope that he would be a non-political figure who would bring two things to pass. He would arrange elections and bring Mali back into some sort of constitutional process, and he would also find a way to get Mali united again because Islamists and Tuaregs and Arabs have taken over the north and separated Mali into two. And he disappointed on all of those counts. He hasn't really turned out to be a clever political figure. He hasn't given leadership, and I think everybody was frustrated with him from the top down.
So do you think Amadou Sanogo, the leader of the coup in March, was involved in removing Prime Minister Diarra?
Oh yes, according to reports, he gave instructions to arrest the Prime Minister. And he's playing a very ambiguous role. It's not at all clear that he really organized the mutiny. It's rather that he was brought forward as a spokesman because none of the corporals and sergeants really had any real mastery of the French language, for a start. And the official language of Mali is French. It's really a band of gangsters in uniform with weapons, more or less, but not entirely, controlled by Captain Sanogo.
The Economic Community of West African States and the African Union support military intervention in Mali to respond to violence in the north and the growing power of Islamic militants. Where did Diarra stand on military intervention, and was this an issue behind his removal from power?
Well, it may well have been, but I'm not sure that Diarra stood anywhere, really. What we have is the French really lobbying to intervene in northern Mali to get rid of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The trouble is that the French are 10 years too late. They should have done it when the cocaine route first started 10 years ago. I think the idea of sending in ECOWAS troops would be very counterproductive. I don't think that any serious analyst really believes that it would be successful. Just imagine you have Al-Qaeda-trained Arab Algerians in the desert, and they have a lot of weapons, and they have a lot of experience, and some of them actually fought in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union years ago. And against them, you want to send in who? You want to send in troops of different nationalities, Nigerians who speak English and Togolese who speak French, who are ill-equipped to fight in the desert. It just wouldn't work. It would be a fiasco.
Government officials had been meeting with Tuareg rebels in recent weeks. How do these negotiations factor into the current crisis?
Not clear to me at all whether to what extent Diarra was really involved in that. These are negotiations which are taking place under the auspices of ECOWAS and the official mediator, who's Blaise Compaoré, the president of Burkina Faso, and they are ongoing. And you can see interviews with various of the Tuareg and other negotiators on YouTube and so on. Nobody's saying how far they've gone. But it is quite clear, I think, that the Tuaregs do not want a separate Azawad nation in the north. They claimed that they wanted it, but I think that was a negotiating position. And I don't think that the Tuaregs have any real illusions that, firstly, you can't run a state which is in the middle of the Sahara Desert, completely cut off from everywhere. But what they do want, and that is perfectly justified, they want a bigger share of the national pie. The Tuaregs are probably only 10% of the northern population, but they do have a lot of charisma, they do have a lot of weapons, and we need to listen to them. And some sort of federal solution is what will probably come out of this eventually.
The UN says almost 350,000 Malians have fled their homes, and nearly half of them are now taking refuge in neighbouring countries. How serious do you see the refugee crisis in Mali now, and what impact is this having on the drought-stricken Sahel region?
Well, there's no doubt that the humanitarian crisis is disastrous. I have friends who are who've fled their houses, and some people who've had their houses burned down. It's very most unfortunate, really. It's very, very sad. All the cities of Mali now have disparate populations come in from the north. So they are overwhelmed, really. And then there are sizable camps now in Niger, in Burkina, in Mauritania, and this is a humanitarian disaster.
As you've mentioned, military intervention in Mali is being discussed at the United Nations with support from the European Union and France for military intervention. But what do Mali civilians say about the issue, and is there support from people on the ground for this sort of intervention?
Well, Malian civilians are remarkably unrealistic, I have to say. There are a large number of young people, and if you read them on the internet, they're even more gung-ho on the internet than they are in Bamako, saying we must walk up to the north and recapture Mali. But what with? You don't have an army. They don't have an army. The best regiment in the Malian army was the parachute regiment, and that had now been disbanded by Senegal because there was a conflict between the Red Berets and the Green Berets. What you have in the north, on the other hand, is a range of armies. There's the ACMI, the Al-Qaeda army. There's Ansar Dine, which is a mixture of Islamists and Tuaregs. There's Mujao, which is a mixture of Mauritanian Arab drug smugglers and various sort of mercenaries that they've hired in. And then there's the MNLA, which are Tuaregs, many of whom came back from Libya. Eventually, some sort of negotiation will have to take place.
Dr. Robin Edward Poulton, Mali expert at Virginia Commonwealth University School of World Studies, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
In Myanmar's Rakhine state, tens of thousands remain displaced. The United Nations is calling on Myanmar, also known as Burma, to prioritize reconciliation efforts and provide citizenship to the stateless Muslim Rohingya after violence between Buddhists and Muslims earlier this year. Many are living in overcrowded and unsanitary camps. FSRN's Ron Corbin has more.
After weeks of intense clashes in June and October that killed nearly 200 and left thousands of homes and buildings destroyed, tensions remain high between Buddhist and Muslim communities. Displaced people have been living in temporary camps for months without access to jobs and school. The United Nations Chief for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, travelled to 8 camps in western Rakhine State. She says while conditions varied, the Maibon refugee camp was particularly shocking.
The camp is one of the worst that I've seen because it is extremely crowded. The tents themselves that people are sheltering under are of extraordinarily poor quality and almost non-existent. So people are very crowded. Men, women, children inside these tents that are basically for smaller numbers of people. The sanitation is very, very poor indeed. Water, so people getting getting access to water for bathing, for cooking and so on is terrible. There is no school and the children cannot go to school anywhere else.
Amos says Myanmar faces several humanitarian challenges. Up to 500,000 people are internally displaced from multiple local conflicts, especially in the eastern areas near Thailand and China. She held talks with President Thein Sein and welcomed the reforms he has implemented over the past 18 months. But she called for the government to address their concerns and offered UN assistance. The issue of citizenship for stateless Muslim Rohingya is highly sensitive in the country. Many Buddhists claim the Rohingya are Bengali.
Donors and countries need to continue to put pressure on the government of Myanmar to sort out the issues of citizenship and at the same time to begin the process of reconciliation. Having visited 8 camps in these communities, it's my view that whilst there is clearly a very strong lack of trust, that local leaders and national leaders need to help to bring the communities together to begin the discussion.
The UN says they have raised $27 million in aid for the displaced in Rakhine State, but need a further $41 million by June 2013. Amos is also concerned about thousands of internally displaced people in eastern Kachin State. The UN says 75,000 people have been forced from their homes due to fighting between the Kachin Independence Army and Myanmar's military. Amos says aid was badly needed to assist 40,000 people in areas where the UN lacks access. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
There's a new war building up south of the border. It's gone virtually unreported in the media, even though it involves US troops. Tune in to FSRN on Christmas Day for a hard look at how the US-backed war on drugs is impacting Guatemala.
El Estado necesita de algo.
The state needs something to make the population believe that there needs to be militarization in order to control everything. That something had to be invented, and it's called drug trafficking.
16 years after the end of Guatemala's bloody internal armed conflict, the war on drugs and organized crime has become a rallying cry for increased militarization. Some, however, contest the idea that drugs are what's really at stake. Tune in to FSRN on Christmas Day for an in-depth examination of the causes and consequences of the US-backed war on drugs in Guatemala. That's Tuesday, December 25th, on your community station and on fsrn.org. The Seattle-based company SSA Marine is proposing to build North America's largest coal export terminal in Washington State. If approved, more than 150 million tons of coal would be shipped from Wyoming's Powder River Basin through Washington and Oregon to destinations in Asia. Government officials are holding public hearings, including two in Seattle and Vancouver this week. At a recent meeting in Bellingham, opponents of the project voiced their concerns about pollution and coal's contribution to global warming. FSRN's Martha Baskin reports.
At a rally outside the hearing, music from the Lummi tribe welcomed the crowd. Commercial fisherman Walter Young said he didn't have prepared remarks, only what was in his heart.
And what's in my heart is I care about our Mother Earth. I care that corporations want to come in and rape and plunder and go away and leave us holding the bag.
In testimony, Young recalled when a smelter facility in Telco was built, ships from all over the world began to dock in Bellingham. Millions of gallons of bilge or water-containing oil, chemicals, waste, and foreign organisms were discharged into nearshore waters. The first victim was the herring run, says Young. Once the Puget Sound's largest herring stock, populations have fallen dramatically.
We dropped the ball and did not make them conform to EPA regulations, and we're paying the price for it.
The Lummi tribe have fished off Washington's coast for hundreds of years and want to preserve the tradition for the next 7 generations. Jay Julius, a full-time fisherman with the tribe, says his livelihood is already impacted by vessel traffic from oil and chemical tankers, cargo and commercial fishing vessels, and passenger and cruise ships. In 2011, there were an estimated 5,000 transits through Washington waters. Shipping coal to Asia could add hundreds of more tankers over the next 15 years.
These will be monstrous tankers. So if I'm out there outside of Cherry Point where I fish, and I am currently fishing today as we speak, and it's foggy, I can't get out of the way, nor can they stop.
Julius says the impacts would be devastating to his people, as well as everyone in the state who survives by fishing.
If this goes through, it is rape of the Point Elliott 1855 treaty.
Point Elliott ceded land to the federal government in exchange for preserving the right to harvest salmon.
We have experienced molestation of the treaty in the past. For the last 157 years, this would be a dagger in us. It would be ripping our heart out.
The majority who came to testify were against the proposal to build North America's largest coal export terminal. Julie Trimmingham spoke as a mother concerned about raising her own child in a healthy environment, as well as raising children everywhere.
How will the coal that we are exporting to China exacerbate climate change and ocean acidification?
Diesel particulates from transporting coal is a serious concern, she says, because it's been shown to cause cancer, asthma, heart disease.
We all breathe the same air. What burns in Asia doesn't necessarily stay in Asia. Mercury and other pollutants, toxins, cross the Pacific Ocean and affect our air and our water.
A minority of those who testified were in favor of the proposal. A man who wouldn't give his name, wearing a pro-coal terminal t-shirt, said he once worked at a coal mine in Montana. He said coal is treated with chemicals to prevent coal dust and that health concerns from shipping coal in open rail cars were overblown.
They form a hard crust across top of it. It's almost like having it covered anyways.
But jobs were the main reason he supports building the coal export terminal.
We have a lot of unemployed people up here. A lot of people depend on the food banks and food stamps. And I think a lot of people want to have those jobs, and they will be good jobs.
A major backer of the proposed Bellingham coal terminal is Peabody Coal, which is looking to find more lucrative markets in Asia following a decline in demand for coal in the U.S. Eric DePlace is with the Sightline Institute, a nonprofit think tank. He says the investment is a gamble.
Any fair reading of the landscape would conclude that it is fraught with uncertainty, it's fraught with competing signals, and lots of volatility.
DePlace says if history is a guide, coal can spike, then collapse, and do so multiple times. Even if the demand for coal exists, he asks, is the U.S. better positioned to supply it than coal-exporting countries closer to China? Countries like Australia, Vietnam, or Mongolia?
Probably not. That's kind of the big cloud of uncertainty that hangs over all of this stuff.
The next hearing on the proposed terminal is scheduled for December 13th in Seattle. Originally planned for a community college, the hearings were moved to the State Convention Center because of the high volume of people wanting to testify. Martha Baskin, FSRN.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.